this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:02 p.m. It is Friday, April 14, 2017. Before we begin, I want to thank Christie Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Kelsey Goodell from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and everyone in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Kopp, Representative Fansley, my vice chair, and myself, Representative Clayman. I think Representative Ledoux is momentarily going to be with us, and then we'll have a quorum, and I'll say that when it happens. Our first order of business today is House Bill 200, Nonpartisan Open Primary Elections, sponsored by Representative Ledoux. I'd note that Representative Reinbold has joined us, and we now have a quorum. This is the second hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee, and today I would like to open up for public testimony on this bill. So I will open up for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Then going to the folks online, the first person we have, William Harrington, is calling in from Anchorage. Mr. Harrington, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
So, Mr. Harrington, just note we limit public testimony to three minutes per person. Go ahead. And Representative Christ Tompkins has also joined us. Go ahead, Mr. Harrington.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Please state your name and any affiliation you may have.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Thank you very much for asking.
Are you on a speakerphone or a regular telephone?
I'm not on the telephone. I'm at the LIO.
Oh, you're at the LIO. Okay. Go ahead.
The back to affiliation. I have no official affiliation, but I am a private sector retiree as opposed to a public sector employee. I think that's very important when we're discussing the debt of other bills. But anyway, let's get a little bit here. How is it that with all the crises you legislators face this year, this bill is given the time of day? How does this bill fix a problem that has been festering for years? As a similar bill is proposed in the
Hold on just a minute, Mr. Harrington. I'm just working with the folks with the sound here. He needs to slow down. If you could talk a little bit slower and maybe move it back a little from the microphone when you're speaking into, because it's a little hard to understand. You're loud and clear, but a little too loud, actually, and a little not clear enough.
I will try to modulate my voice.
That's much better. Go ahead.
I'm going to assume you didn't get the first part, so we'll just start over.
That's fine. I'll let you start your time over.
You legislators face this year, this bill is given the time of day. Does this bill fix a problem that has been festering for years? Has a similar bill been proposed in the last 10 years? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. In Section 11 of this bill, it should just be replaced with an amendment that no party affiliations are listed on the ballot. Just names in alphabetical order. That way, no party can complain of trademark infringement or wolves in sheep's clothing. Drop the labels, drop the problem. Please pass this bill so that I can watch in amazement as the unintended consequences for both major political parties unfold going forward, or, as people from the past say, in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harrington. I don't see any questions. Next, I have Daniel Lynch calling in from Soldotna. Mr. Lynch.
Good afternoon, neighbors. Daniel Lynch, Soldotna, speaking for myself and independent neighbors. I am a nonpartisan super voter, as are 53% of registered voters in the state. Thanks for the chance to comment on HB 200. I'd like to begin my comments by requesting an amendment or a companion bill simply ending any government spending on primary elections or state funding for a beauty contest for private political parties. I've studied this issue the last decade and a half. Statewide primaries cost between $6 and $2.5 million per cycle. The state is in financial strain. Where to cut is the question. Here's an easy button for you. The state constitution, Article 5, states in part, Number one, qualified voters. Number two, disqualifications. Number three, methods of voting. Number four, voting precincts. And number five, general elections. It does not say anything about the state funding a primary election. For our neighbors and citizens whom choose to belong to any political party or political group, that would be the minority of voters, they can fund their own beauty contest. They did it successfully just last year. The Republicans organized and funded their PPP. The Democrats organized and funded their caucus. And the other parties and groups had conventions and member mail-ins. That helps the economy and doesn't cost state funds, which are better spent elsewhere, perhaps pioneer homes, education, or anywhere that is in the constitutional requirements. Locally and statewide, all other groups, such as the AGA Co-op, the VFW, AmVets, IBW, Teamsters, etc., figure and finance their own elections for leaders, boards, rules, and decisions. They don't come to the state for funding. In my 20-plus years in the state, I can give you one example after another of primary blunders and waste, all at state government expense. Recently, District 40, two Democratic candidates, results challenged by Republican Pooperman Babcock, then the state has to pay for judges and court expenses and time to hash it out. It should have been left up to the Democratic Party to choose their candidate. District 29 and others, one unopposed candidate and race costing the state dollars. District 30, which is my district, four Republican candidates trying to be the man. The Republican Party could have rented one polling place and one in Soldotna to determine by their members their choice for the general election. No state funds. Mr. Malott and Mr. French's primary, Vic Corey's primary, two different offices with two different parties. It goes on and on every year.
Mr. Lynch, you're at about your 3 minutes. If you could go ahead and conclude, that'd be great.
I'll just clean it up right here. 2014, we had an August referendum on SB 21.
Actually, Mr. Lynch, I need you to conclude.
Whether you call it open primary?
No, I need you to conclude your comments. Do you support the bill or not support the bill?
Obviously, you weren't listening. I don't support it.
I'm just making sure that we all heard. Okay, thank you very much for taking the time to comment on this bill. I would note before we take the next person calling in that Representative Eastman and Representative Ledoux have both joined us. And next on the list is George Pierce, who is with us at the Kenai LIO from Kasiwof. Mr. Pierce.
Yes, my name is George Pierce. I'm here at the LIO office. I'm representing Kasiwof in my community. This bill, I don't know about this bill. You know, it's amazing that you guys come up with, you know, you got more important things to do besides waste our time with this stuff here. One thing I do not like, the effective date. I appreciate Ms. Ledoux for coming up with this. But on the effective date, on the explanation of changes, what you need to do is change that effective date from 2020 to 2018. You have to stop funding everything that goes on in this state. If people want to do this, they need to stop and step up to the plate and spend their money instead of the state's money, and it's not your responsibility to keep funding them. So I request that you make some adjustments to this bill, and thank you for taking my testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pierce. Next we have from the Mat-Su LIO, Eugene Haberman. Mr. Haberman, can you hear us?
Yes. Please know my middle name, C-A-R-L with a C. Okay. My name is Eugene Carl Haberman. I represent myself. I follow the public process. If the public process is done appropriately, the decision made by the governing body is more likely in the public interest.
Mr. Haberman, if you could slow down just a little bit.
Okay, no problem. But your limited time doesn't give me much chance to speak too much. My comments are in reference to Bill 200. Now, some of you are aware that I have been observing elections, both at the state and local levels. And one key thing that stands out on this bill and deeply concerned is when you're dealing with observing a state election, the end result is I'm denied as a, because I'm not going to be appointed by a party, my ability to observe a state election. What you have here is you've got parties being able to, if you're a member of a given party, they can observe, they can be appointed. But myself, the one person in the state, and some of you are aware of it, that goes back to 2012, an election in Anchorage, I'm denied my right to observe an election, the state election. So I'm deeply concerned about that. But I also should, and a key to ensuring that the election is valid is the ability to observe an election. And without, with this situation, how can you prove that the election is legitimate?
Mr. Haberman, I just want to ask one question from the recording secretary. What town do you live in?
I live in the Mat-Su borough.
Okay, but what city in the Mat-Su?
There's no town because I live in an area that is not city of Wasilla, city of Palmer, or city of Houston.
He lives in the unincorporated areas of the Mat-Su borough. Okay, thank you for that brief introduction. Go ahead.
Okay, now, I don't know what I'm going to say any more about this except that, here's a line that frequently I've addressed is the most important issue that faces a government body is dealing with elections. Next is appropriations dealing with budget. And this deals with elections. This deals with state election. And the more complex and complicated an issue is, the more notice, the more opportunity for the public to be heard. I should note, in reference to this bill, there seems to be a lot of changes of when you were going to hear this bill. Originally was scheduled for 1 o'clock on Monday, and then it got delayed to 4:05. This situation has, and I noticed another situation that was going to be heard at another date, and then it's being heard now. If you or anybody expects to hear from the public on any bill, including this one, you need to give a fair opportunity for the public to be heard, and this moving around with what you've done ensures the public's not really connected to know that they have a chance to speak on this bill.
Mr. Haberman, I'm very pleased that you've had the opportunity to call in and provide your testimony. You also have come to the 3 minutes that we limit public testimony, so I'll ask you to conclude.
I'm done.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Reinbold has a question.
Eugene, first of all, I want to thank you for attending so many meetings and for paying attention. Even for us that are in the room, this has been very challenging. I had people interested in testifying the bill, but there's so many bills in play, and the testimony did get switched. You're very prudent, watching things very closely. I thank you that you did have the opportunity, but most people have not been able to have the opportunity to follow things quite as closely as you do, and I know it's very complicated, and I think it's disingenuous to keep changing public testimonies at different times for people. But I would like to say that I think your testimony is very, very important, and if you wouldn't mind, please writing it up and sending in your concerns. You said you were limited time today, which I agree, and I would ask that you put your full comments and that they get typed, and I would ask that they be put in the package and this opportunity provided to everybody else, because I very much want to hear what you have to say, and thank you for calling.
And Mr. Haberman, you can just email those to my office and we'll distribute it to all the members of the Judiciary Committee. Thank you very much. Next,
Mr.
on
Chairman, can I ask a question?
Absolutely. Go ahead, Mr.
Thank you.
Sorry. Representative Eastman.
Through the chair, Eugene, thank you for your comments. Now, you mentioned that this current proposal lacks transparency and the ability to verify what happened after an election. In just a few words, can you recommend what a good fix to that might be? I'm trying to understand the exact problem that you're testifying about.
Permission to chair to speak.
Absolutely. Go ahead and answer Representative Eastman's question.
Okay. I'll be very brief. A good example is that when you deal with the local communities, let's say Anchorage, which is figuring out what their elections, their votes, you know, the ballots and so forth, yesterday I was able to attend and monitor and their meetings. Where they publish their meetings, I'm able to monitor there. But the idea of then you take the borough, which is not a state election. The Massachusetts borough had an election in which they don't advertise when they're doing their ballots. Now, in the case of your bill here, specifically, and dealing with the ability for me to know when to review the ballots and so forth, I am denied. Now, if I went and I had to be appointed by a certain party, okay, that would be my ability to be able to appear at that meeting on those ballots being reviewed. But I'm denied my right. And the fact is, I want to stress this thing. Many people know who I am. I have placed a position that, let's say if I was appointed by a Democrat or Republican, I look at that as a self-interest. I've got to be neutral. And but not allowing...
So, Mr. Haberman, I think Representative Eastman's question was the specific amendment you would offer to change the bill to where you think it would be satisfactory, but I don't think you've really answered that question. Can you answer Representative Eastman's question about how you would recommend amending this bill to be satisfactory?
It should not be limited to the way it's written because it has the appearance of having a self-interest for a given political party, whether Democrat or Republican, than having an observer that is neutral, such as myself.
Okay.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I've got Ken Jacobus calling from Anchorage. I've got to use this as Ken Jacobs, but do I have it right, Ken Jacobus, Mr. Jacobus?
Yes, it is. Yes, sir.
All right. Go ahead and proceed with your testimony and stating your name and any affiliation.
I understand that I have 3 minutes. I submitted some written testimony to the committee. I sent in 2 letters.
Hold on just a second. Just a moment.
This is what happened with him last time. He has to
slow down. Okay. The clerk says to slow down and move back a little bit from the microphone.
Oh, I'm going to turn back. Okay, all right. Don't talk so loud.
Or so fast.
I emailed 2 letters to the committee on Monday and Tuesday.
And we did receive those, Mr. Jacobus.
I'm sorry?
We did receive those letters.
Okay, so I won't go over that stuff. I hope you'll excuse me for calling this the jungle primary, because everybody else calls it the jungle primary, except up here in Alaska. I view it as being a demolition derby. Everyone crashes into everybody else, and the last 2 cars standing get on the general election ballot. There's an interesting article in the Anchorage Dispatch News last Sunday, which I did not send to you, because it's more of an attack on the motivation of Representative Ledoux for filing this bill. I do not think that that's what needs to be looked at. We need to look at whether it's good for Alaska or whether it's not good for Alaska. What you need to do, I'm surprised there are no minor parties here. The only reason they're probably not here is because they don't know about it. The minor parties are going to be destroyed by the jungle primary. There's never been a top 2 election for state or federal office in California or Washington in which a major party was able to qualify for the general election ballot unless there was only one candidate of a major party running for that office. A minor party thus will never be able to meet the 3% requirement to retain qualified party status. In addition, as I pointed out in these articles, political science research and experience demonstrates that the system used in California and Washington does not decrease polarization, does not elect more moderate office holders, and depresses voter turnout. The article that I submitted by Richard Winger demonstrates the depression of the voter turnout that has taken place in California since the adoption of the jungle primary. And what I want to do is spend the rest of the time, you have my writing here, but let me give you a couple of examples. Suppose you have a district which has 60% Democrats, 25% Republicans, 15% Libertarians. You have the jungle primary. The 2 Democrats are going to win the seats on the election ballot, but they're not going to win the general election because the Republican's going to run us through with his 25% as a write-in. The Libertarians are going to join the primary as the Republicans for 40%. Then you have a Republican representative out of the 60% Democrat district. This doesn't make any sense. If you look at extreme candidates, if you have the jungle primary with an extreme left and extreme right candidate and 2 centrist candidates, it works. if you have.
Mr. Jacobus, you're at about 3 minutes, so if you can go ahead and conclude with your remarks, that would be great.
Okay. If you have a lot of, all right, give me about 30 seconds. If you have a lot of candidates, then your extreme candidates are going to win the primary. The centrists won't, because they're going to split the mishmash in the center. But the jungle primary is simply a bad idea. Look what I've sent, but be sure to get the input of the minor parties, because they're the ones that are going to be killed by this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next online, we've got Andrew Sinclair calling from New York City. Mr. Sinclair, if you could state your name and any affiliation you may have, please proceed.
My name is Andrew Sinclair. I'm a clinical assistant professor at NYU's Wagner Graduate School of Public Service. I work in issues of public policy, quantitative research methodology in the United States and in Great Britain. And in addition to some academic articles, I'm also the author of Nonpartisan Primary Election Reform, Mitigating Mischief, a book published with my co-author, Mike Alvarez, through Cambridge University Press in 2015. So this is a book focused on nonpartisan top two primary in California, as was just mentioned by the previous caller, the subject of continuing scholarly activity. I hold a PhD and MS in social science from the California Institute of Technology and a BA in mathematics from Claremont McKenna College. I have a couple points to make, and then I'm happy to take some questions. California has used a nonpartisan primary election rule in 2012, 2014, and 2016. That's enough to say something about it, but there's still a fair amount of considerable disagreement among political scientists about what to look at and what to make of the new rules. California's version of the top two is pretty simple. The two candidates with the most votes advance to the general election. Voters can choose any candidate in the primary. This is a version that is also used in Washington, and there's a few other places that have similar rules. About 15% of the time, two candidates from the same party have faced each other in the general election, although most of the time the general elections look like what you would see under the old system. From my own research, the sort of main thing I would want to note is it appears that the general elections between candidates of the same party are more competitive, and those more competitive elections do happen in the very places where otherwise you'd typically see uncompetitive elections. For some of the other considerations people think about, participation, moderation, it's a little less clear how the top two works in California and how that experience would translate to Alaska. I did want to note that we looked for evidence for disadvantaged minorities and other underrepresented groups and didn't see any compelling evidence for that in our 2015 book. Most of what happens seems to happen through pairing candidates in a different way rather than vastly changing the way voters behave in the primary. In general, we found that voters still picked the candidate they knew something about and that they liked the most rather than behaving in some complicated strategic way. Overall, we found that some voters like the new rules and others do not, but many echo the uncertainty of political scientists about exactly what to expect. So any reform you do comes with some advantages and disadvantages. My job is only to assess how, not really to make recommendations, so I won't make a recommendation one way or the other, but I'm happy to answer any questions you might have and to follow up with any of you later.
Thank you very much. I see the Representative Christ Tompkins has a question. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm interested if you observed any change before and after California adopted the top two system, in which California, on the whole, leans left, although there's some districts that are very right of center and some districts that are very left of center. So for districts of either political character, solidly Democratic or solidly Republican, if you sort of but if there's any way or in any of your studies you observed that there was sort of a race to the ideological extremes prior to the adoption of the top two primary system, and if you saw that changed in any way after the adoption of the top two primary system.
Sure. So there's a lot of academic interest in changes in ideology. Some of the current research that I've seen has suggested that the sort of Democrats in the legislature may have moderated slightly without huge changes in the Republican side. I did a study in one particular districts, which is California Assembly District 5, just currently represented by Frank Bigelow, which is it's a very Republican district, where in 2012, the election was between, two Republican candidates in the general election, one who had declined to sign the no tax increase pledge, and the other one who had done so, Frank Bigelow, who had declined to sign the pledge, still won the election, which is likely a different outcome than would have been obtained under the other rule.
Thank you.
I don't see other questions. I did have one question. The prior speaker had indicated that the top two primary system in California actually showed a reduction in voter participation. From your analysis, what's your perspective on what impact it had on voter participation?
Sure. I think it's important to keep voter participation in context, that California has experienced declining voter participation over time.
Higher or declining participation? I just didn't hear you clearly.
There were some, I think, pretty unrealistic expectations that the top two would reverse that trend.
So it's declining in California like it is in other states in the country. I'm just making sure I heard you correctly.
Correct.
Okay, go ahead.
And I would hesitate to make a strong claim about how this would translate to Alaska, just because the scale of politics in California is very different. So statewide office in Alaska is roughly equivalent to a single California state Senate seat by population. And so the campaign technologies are very different. There's, in the work that I've done, there's some sort of very preliminary evidence that you may get a very, very, very small decrease in participation when you have two candidates at the same party. It's possible. But that's still ongoing research. And it's really hard to establish the counterfactual of what would happen if we were using the old system, given the, sort of secular decline in participation across the country.
Representative Ledoux has a question.
So sure. I assume when someone is talking about decline in voter participation, they must be talking about for the general election. Just for curiosity, what's happened to voter participation, if anything, vis-a-vis the primary elections?
Sure. The pattern in 2012 and 2014 in California, which is what I know the best, and we're still processing the 2016 data, it was actually quite different, so it worked a little differently in the presidential year of 2012, and so the way that voter choice works in presidential years may be quite different than non-presidential years. But I would hesitate to make too big of claims on the sort of participation side, and especially to translate that into the Alaska experience. The differences were not nearly as large as I expected. Either one way or the other.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much. Next on the list is Jason Olson calling in from New York. Mr. Olson, if you could proceed to state your name and your affiliation.
Sure. My name is Jason Olson. I'm the Director of National Organizing for Open Primaries. Before I begin, I just want to say I'm testifying in favor of HB 200 and efforts to bring back an open primary to Alaska. I want to thank Representative Ledoux for the invitation to testify, and of course, I'd like to thank the committee members for their time and attention to this important matter. So Open Primaries is a nonprofit, national, nonpartisan organization with a singular mission, and that's to ensure that no American citizen is required to join a political party in order to vote in a primary. And we're working in red states, blue states, purple states, and we work with Republicans, Democrats, and independents on this issue around the country. My personal background is that I founded a group of independent voters in California that partnered with the coalition led by Republican former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to bring a top two open primary to California, as well as reform the redistricting process. And since then, I've worked on this issue of open primaries in various states around the country. So why is restoring Alaska's open primary worth the support of the Alaska State Legislature? Well, in short, the voters of Alaska, along with those in California and Washington State, had their open primary stolen by a terrible court decision in the year 2000. In that case, the California Democratic Party sued the state of California, California had adopted Alaska's open primary system in 1996, and they sued in order to close the primary elections. In one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in a generation, the court sided with the political establishment of both parties against our citizens' basic freedom to vote for the elected representatives of their choice. This, despite the fact that primary elections are, in fact, taxpayer-funded, run by government employees, and conducted on publicly owned voting machines. So Alaska, California, and Washington State, all which have the same open primary system, were forced to return to the semi-closed primary the voters in each state had previously rejected. That's what Alaska is still using to this day. This put all of the states in a very difficult position. So voters in those other states fought back and passed new open primaries through ballot initiative. And for this, they looked to Nebraska, which has used the top two open primary since 1934 for its legislative races. Under a top two open primary, voters are free to vote for whoever they want. Legislators are free to do what they think is right for their constituents rather than having to toe the party line. And most of them in these states absolutely love it. The impact in California has been tremendous. I don't want to repeat things that Andy said, but the legislators' approval rating is up from a low of 14% before the change back to 45% today. Budgets are passed on time. Voter participation and registration has begun to rebound. I agree with Andy that initially it continued to decline, but it's like a 747 in a steep nosedive. You pull back on the stick, it doesn't automatically shoot back up, but it rebounded over time. And
Mr. Olson, we limit public testimony to 3 minutes per person, so you've come to your 3 minutes. If you could conclude, that would be great.
Seconds. I have about 10 seconds more. I'm happy to wrap up. So the voter turnout in California in 2016's primary was 48%. In short, HB 200 is Alaska's chance to finally win back its open primary. We urge you to support it, and we're happy to advise and assist in its passage in any way possible. Thank you.
I don't see any questions. I will just double check again. I don't see anyone else online. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on this issue? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to close the public testimony. Any further discussion from the committee? Representative Reinbold, you look like you've got a comment.
Well, there's several different comments in regards to this, but my understanding is we're going to be holding the bill. Is that correct?
The plan is that we will take this up again tomorrow. Amendments will be due at 5 o'clock this afternoon, so we'll take it up again tomorrow and move it out of committee tomorrow. But if you want to, you're certainly welcome to wait for tomorrow if you want.
Well, I guess there's several concerns. I am looking at legislative research reports, and the one that I just happen to be looking at right now is Max Grunberg that was prepared for Representative Grunberg, which this room is named after. And basically, Republicans, Democrats, Libertarian parties challenged the blanket primary, claiming that the law on its face violated the party's association rights. And I just encourage everyone, I can't read this whole thing. It would take probably half an hour. But I will tell you, both in California, this has been challenged, and also in Washington. It has headed up to the Supreme Court. And Chief Justice Roberts, with whom Justice Alito joined in concurring, they agreed with Justice Scalia's dissent comments in regards to that permitting a candidate to identify with his or her political party preference based on an official election ballot, regardless of whether the candidate is endorsed by the party or is even a member, may effectively force parties to accept candidates they do not want, accounting to a forced association in violation of the First Amendment rights. This issue of the violation of First Amendment rights of political parties is very, very serious, and I know there's opposition both in the Democrat and Republican parties in regards to this. I'd also like to note Justice Scalia and Kennedy had some very, very important comments. Again, I can't read all of them, so I'm going to just say that one of their key points was that this impairs the party's advocacy of its standard bearer for their candidate. And among the First Amendment rights that political parties possess is the right to associate with the persons whom they choose and refrain from associating with the persons they reject. I am very strongly against this, and I just felt like it was very important to get those comments on record. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Reinbold. Representative Ledoux.
Yes, I just want to confirm that you are reading from a dissenting opinion as opposed to the majority opinion, which is actually the law of the land.
Representative Reinbold, actually, before you respond, can you actually tell us the name of the case you're reading from so that we actually have that in the record? It always helps to know what case they're
And Mr. Chairman, writing. I was reading from both. And that's why
can you just tell us the name of the case at the top?
But there's two different cases involved here. One of them was the Washington State petitioner, Washington State Republican Party, and the other one.
Who's the opponent?
It's Grange. It's a Washington Grange petitioner, Washington State Republican Party, et al. Washington petitioners in the Supreme Court, and then the second one was the one in California.
Would you mind, if you'll pass me the papers, I'll just identify the cases.
And Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman, what I'm speaking, I spoke to the concurrence, and then I also spoke to the dissent.
Okay. I'll just make sure we get that. One case is Washington State versus Washington State Republican Party, which appears at, looks like 2008 U.S. Lexus 2707, and that actually appears to be the only case that's been cited.
There's another case in there in that research as well.
There may be other cases in the research, but the cases that you're quoting from are all this is only one case.
That was the Supreme Court, but they did reference both cases in there.
Okay. Did you want to respond further to represent, or did you respond all you need?
No, I was reading from both the concurrence and the dissent, Mr. Speaker.
Okay. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I wanted to just comment first on the explanation of changes from O to U. The criminalization of ballot marking, I think, was a good change. I think it's important that if there's applications out there that they come clean and we allow the voters to pick without having those choices sort of made for them in advance. So I think that was a good find. I'm curious, a question more for the sponsor. Now, I know in this bill, you know, obviously we're talking about top two, and you know, obviously when you have two, you're going to get a majority one way or the other if you only have two candidates. I suppose if you've got, write-in is still an option, I think, so I guess it's still possible you could get less than the majority, but probably not expected. But I know Anchorage decided to go away from the 50% model to the 45. I was wondering if you had considered that and if that's something that might be worth considering as well.
Representative Ledoux.
I guess I'm not following you. I mean, Anchorage does a 45%, and if you get 45%, then you don't have to be in a runoff for the mayor. So you're suggesting that if one candidate got 45% in a primary election, that you cancel the general election? I mean, is that your idea?
Well, I'm looking at the fact that we're sort of, you know, opening up, changing the primary and general election and how these are all working. And of the various options out there, I know that's certainly one. I think Anchorage is the only one that's tried it. But did you, you know, kind of compare the process that they're following, you know, and you're putting together this proposal and you know, any thoughts on this as opposed to that? Obviously, you came up with this proposal. So is there a contrast? Any comments or thoughts there?
Before Representative Ledoux answers, I think, Representative Eastman, you're getting some of the details of the Anchorage election system confused with the state system, because Anchorage many years ago adopted a nonpartisan election. And so there's never parties listed, and the only election that allows a runoff is the mayor's election, and that's only if someone doesn't prevail by, you know, it's switched up back and forth between 40% and 45%. So I don't really remember today whether it's 40% or 45% to prevail to avoid a runoff in the mayor's election. But in the assembly levels, there's never been that 45% requirement, so it's always been in recent years a plurality. And so that in the assembly level, it's just one election, whoever has the plurality. And in the state level today, in the when Murkowski won as a write-in candidate is the perfect example that on the state level, the elections, including the governor, has never needed the majority. It's always been a plurality that prevails in all of our state general elections. So I'm actually a little bit confused by the question, but that was just an interjection. But Representative Ledoux, you can go ahead and respond to the question.
Well, I I'm not sure whether Representative Eastman is referring to 45% in a primary and then they not go on into the general, or the idea that you would need to collect 45% in the general. And I guess the way I'm hoping that this bill is written now, and I'm hoping that it is clear, and if not, we'll be bringing you an amendment, is that whoever wins the general election, if there is somebody who, I mean, there are only going to be two candidates who are actually on the ballot. If there's, and I've always said, well, that will mean that there'll be 50% plus one would win the election. But if there is a write-in candidate, then that there possibly would be the case where there wasn't 50% plus one. The intention of this bill is then that in the general election, it would be whoever wins the plurality of the votes. And if that isn't clear, we need to make it clear.
Thank you. That goes to the heart of the question. I appreciate the answer, yeah.
Does that answer the question?
I didn't ask the question very well, and I appreciate you figuring it out for me.
But does that answer the question?
Yes, it does. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I know you did reference the Nexus-Lexis, but I will was able to pull out the three cases that they were referring to, and I know there's more, but it's Washington State versus the State Republican Party, the Democrat Party of the U.S. versus Wisconsin, and California Democrat Party versus Jones. So those are
okay. Thank you very much. Any further comments or discussion? I don't see any. If anyone is considering offering an amendment to House Bill 200, please let my office know and submit them by 5 p.m. this evening to allow enough time to distribute before Saturday's meeting, when it will be my intention to take up all amendments to House Bill 200 and move the bill out of committee. And accordingly, we will hold House Bill 200 this time for further review.
Mr. Chairman, a question.
Yes, Representative Easton.
Now, I had submitted a request for an amendment for House Bill 200 a little while back. Still haven't got it yet, but would love to be able to submit it by 5. But I understand that based on our meeting last evening, sometimes that isn't enough. But I did want to let the committee know that I have submitted that, and I certainly made every effort of getting it in on time. And I don't know, I suspect, actually I'm pretty sure it's past the drafter stage, but I don't know where it is in their process.
Okay. Well, I certainly, if you've been working to get an amendment, my staff advises that the question you had, I think Representative Ledoux has already drafted an amendment that will be, that may address the very issue that you're concerned with. I'm not
possibly
sure.
Possibly. I think that was the second issue.
But I'm not sure because I haven't seen that proposed amendment, but all I can say is check with Ledgely. You'll get an update. If you requested it a few days ago and they still haven't gotten to it, I would certainly it's one thing when someone requests an amendment at 4 o'clock in the afternoon from Ledge Legal and they don't get it in time. I'm a lot less sympathetic if you requested it a week or two ago. That's a whole different. That's one in which I would certainly consider the circumstances. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will there be an opportunity for committee comment tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. Consistent with what we always do before we move the bill. Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it is going to be tough to get amendments through by 5, knowing that we're going to get out of here at probably 3 or 3:30 and then getting them over to Ledge Legal. I know yesterday during a bill, my amendments were ready. They were sent to you. They were denied. I made copies. I made backup documents. I handed them to the aide, and they were not passed out. And there was a whole total of 25 minutes from virtually 25 minutes from the time that we got an overview of the bill till the time that the bill got moved out. Public testimony was probably 10 seconds. And I am just want to put on record that I am having a very hard time with the process. Public testimonies are not being, we're not given warnings of them. Public testimony times are being changed. Amendments are being rushed. Bills are being rolled out. And I just want to say, just because you can doesn't mean that you should. Thank you.
And Representative Reinbold, I just note we announced last night that amendments to this bill were going to be due at 5 o'clock tonight. So that notice has been out there for some time, and we have consistently had a deadline for amendments in this committee all year. So that's not anything new. Did you want to respond?
I'm just saying things are happening very quickly, and as you know, you were a member of the minority, and a lot of times our stuff is rolled to the bottom over in Ledge Legal, and it's very difficult, and we are fighting very hard to get things in on time, but with extremely short notice, with that times changes, with public testimony not being necessarily made public, just being in this very, very quick rush thing, I'm very alarmed with the rate of some hugely important issues being pushed out of here without proper vetting and without the opportunity to weigh in enough and without fully understanding. And I'll give you an example of Senate Bill 55. I registered these concerns very strongly yesterday on record, and they were noted. And I'm registering them again, and I have also spoken to leadership that I do not appreciate what happened in this committee yesterday with Senate Bill 55. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
Yes, I would just like to point out that Legislative Legal is a nonpartisan agency, and that it does not roll minority bills or minority amendments or minority questions to the bottom of the pile. And I don't think that attack on Legislative Legal, suggesting that they're anything other than nonpartisan, is appropriate.
And I'd like to speak to that.
I'm going to give you a chance, but Representative Cutt seems to be raising hands all around the table. This is what I'm going to do about amendment process and legislative, because I want to keep moving on to House Bill 208. I'm going to give everyone a chance to speak on this topic. And Representative Reinbold, you brought it up. I'll give you the last word. Representative Kopp.
Yes, I agree. Representative Ledoux is right that Ledge Legal is nonpartisan, but where she is incorrect is that they only have a finite amount of human resource, and they actually put out a very detailed memo that states that what their priority 1, 2, 3, 4 are, and the minority is at the bottom of that priority. I have the memo. But it's a matter of resource in what they have. You're right, it's nonpartisan, but because resources are limited, they have to say how they prioritize, so just to clarify.
I'd like to see that memo.
Yeah. And Representative Eastman, did you have any comments? It looked like you did, but
I've seen that memo as well. Thank you.
Okay. And Representative Fanzer, did you want to add anything
to
the discussion?
No.
Representative Christ Tompkins is passing. Last word, Representative Reinbold.
Well, thank you. I think that was a complete unfair characterization of my attack on Ledge Legal. There was zero attack on Ledge Legal at all. I was attacking the process and the process of which it's being moved and different amendment times changing, public process changing. And I will tell you that I absolutely agree that Ledge Legal is supposed to be nonpartisan. So I will agree with both Representative Liu and Representative Kopp in regards to that. However, I was told many, many times that they have priorities, and a lot of times the budget may be the urgent or what leadership tells them, and the majority and the minority switch, and oftentimes the majority does have more sway in regards to what in the order of things that do get done over there. I didn't say Republican versus Democrat. I said majority versus minority, because multiple times I've called over there and been told that. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. That brings us back to House Bill 208, our second order of business today, Trust, Community Property Trust, Powers of Attorney, sponsored by Representative Johnson. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. On Monday, it was suggested by Representative Kopp that the Department of Law come on board and give us some analysis of their fiscal note. So online to speak to that is Assistant Attorney General Renee Wardlaw at the Department of Law. Ms. Wardlaw, are you online and can you hear us well?
Through the chair, guests for the record, my name is Renee Wardbaum, Assistant Attorney General, and I am available to answer questions regarding the fiscal note for House Bill 208.
Actually, what we were hoping you would do rather than just answer questions, if you could actually give us a brief summary about your analysis. The fiscal note actually provides a fairly detailed analysis, and we wanted you to kind of summarize that and talk about that a little bit, and that may prompt some questions.
And through the chair, I have to be honest with House Judiciary that this, in fact, is not a bill that necessarily affects the Department of Law, and as such, we've requested prior to this hearing that Legislative Legal would hopefully have someone online. So I'm not entirely sure if someone else is online, but I think that they would actually be the best party to speak to a summary of the fiscal note and any particular details regarding the bill. At this time, the only information we can offer really truly is limited to what has been contained in the fiscal note.
All right. Does anyone have questions for Ms. Wardlaw that with regard to the information that's contained in the fiscal note? Representative Kopp, go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Wardlaw, for being here. The fiscal analysis put out by the Department of Law is very detailed. And my only question that I brought up in committee is more than just fiscal analysis. Due to the technical nature of the bill, which certainly the Commercial and Fair Practice Division, Fair Business Practice Division would be involved with, that it was legally sound.
Oh, and through the chair, I can assert to you that, in fact, this is legally sound based upon our review. Just a technical point, the Commercial and Fair Business section of the Department of Law actually does not administer Alaska Statute Title 13. Oddly enough, there are two sections in the Alaska statutes that address trust, and we're much more familiar with Alaska Statute Title 26. And so what is in contained here that relates to Title 13 really contains our limited experience with Title 13. A small distinction, but may clarify why I'm hesitant to give more information on this area of law as opposed to another area of law that I'm much more familiar with.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Wardlaw? I don't see any. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Hearing and seeing none, we have already opened and closed public testimony. And I would note that part of the reason my office did contact all the members of the committee to see if anyone was interested in offering amendments, and the answer we got from everyone was no one was interested in offering amendments, which is why we didn't notice amendments previously, but why we're going to go forward without taking up amendments. Is there any further discussion with regard to House Bill 208?
Mr. Speaker, I think it's
discussion or comments. Yes,
you said discussion. Yeah, so I just wanted to point committee members to the memo put together by Peak Trust Company. Reasons to decant a trust. There are four different scenarios that show why this bill is important. It appears actually there's five, and it appears it's really going to update our trust statutes. Keep Alaska in a leadership role for those types of planning estates and investments to continue in our state, and I really appreciate the bill sponsor bringing this forward. Thank you.
And I would just note I need to correct, it was not my office that contacted members of the committee, it was the bill sponsor that contacted all the offices to see if they had amendments. So I would just want to make that clear. Representative Eastman, I think you had a comment or a question.
Yes, just a comment. I noticed there's a number of letters of support, and it looks like the sponsor certainly done a good amount of legwork to make sure that the support was generated for this bill. So good job.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, and I also wanted to say it was some of the best testimony that I had heard with explanation with Matthew Blattmacher from PEAK, and also appreciated the multiple letters, you know, of support that we got, and taking time to come to our offices, taking time to ask us if we wanted amendments. I feel like this bill was went through the process much better, and I really felt like we had an opportunity to thoroughly vet it. I think we had a full, how we're just on the sectional. So I think this is a good example of how a committee process should work and how a bill should be presented, and it was not crammed, forced through. And I really appreciate working with your office and also the way that this bill was handled in this committee. So definitely support it as well. Thank you.
Representative Fansler.
And I'd like to thank the bill sponsor for bringing this forward. I don't think I'm going to quite oppose this bill in this committee, but I am extremely leery anytime we are changing our trust and estate laws. Those have been, especially at the request of the industry, and that was how I first heard about this. And that to me is always a great concern. I think we have longstanding and very well-established trust and estate laws, as we heard from our compelling testimony. Anytime you start to fiddle with something and changing it, it creates a great pause for me. So although I won't object to this passing out of this committee, I can say that I have great pause with this kind of legislation and feel that it needs to be given absolute highest level of review at all times.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The subject and this bill is like Greek to me, so I don't really feel like I understand what's passing out of the committee, and I want to...
Especially that some of us think you studied Greek at some point in your educational career.
I sure wish I had. Maybe I should have studied trust law. But so I just sort of want to note that. I also note the lack of opposition. Having some perspective from the administration, or I guess sort of a third-party source, I thought would have been helpful for me is definitely a complete layperson on the subject to maybe sort of assess the nature of sort of modernization of trust law. And trying to get a sense of this industry and the regulations surrounding this industry, and whether there are any sort of concessions or sacrifices, whether they're consumer protection or to the state in terms of revenue or anything else, or whether it really is a statutory modernization process. And I don't really feel I have the answer to that, although given that there hasn't been a single peep of opposition or letter or anything, I guess it seems like a good thing, but I mostly want to note I'm not totally sure what's in this bill, and I'm very unfamiliar with the subject, but appreciate the work the sponsor's done.
That got some more comments coming. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, obviously modernization is part of it, and I'll echo Representative Ansler in the sense that anytime someone comes to me with a bill and says, you know, don't worry about this, it's just modernizing things, I immediately worry. But there's also another aspect which is at play in that, you know, each of the states has their own laws, and depending on the quality of those laws and the flexibility of those laws, you will see migrations of professions and capital, and the market is the market. So it's not just modernization, I think, that's taking place in bills like this. You're also looking at how can we be competitive against other states for market share. And I will just put for the record, my intent, such as it is that it be both modern and competitive. I think competitive is not necessarily means that we're giving into industry. I think it just means that, you know, we want to attract investment in Alaska.
Representative Ledoux.
And so while I can see where Representative Fansler is coming from, this trust law stuff is not generally a matter of hugely rich people on one side and hugely poor people on the other side, that perhaps the hugely rich people might have the lawyers and the lobbyists and so forth, so that we are obligated to make sure that the legislation isn't skewed against the poor people. Pretty much so, the whole trust field is made up of fairly affluent, sophisticated people. And while this is complicated, the fact that we don't have a single letter of opposition, and again, this is trust law, is something that people who do it pay attention to. And there's nobody who seemingly has a problem with this. To me, that says quite a lot.
Anybody further comment before I make my comments? I don't see any. This is an area, I support this bill. I think it's a good bill. It presents Representative Christ Tompkins raised a question the other day about kind of where was this in relation to the other states, and it gets to the competitiveness question. And there are certainly areas of the law where we are really well served to kind of wait till the movement starts coming from all the states and they realize there's an issue. And a perfect example is the bill we passed and has now been made it through both houses, the Revised Uniform Fiduciary Act, Access to Digital Assets Act, which was an act that came from the Uniform Law Commission that was a response to more and more people coming and saying, you know, with all this internet technology and bank accounts online and they don't want paper statements and Google and Facebook and all these different things and they have access to information, what are you going to do? And rather than being kind of ahead in the lead, really the legislatures in those instances are actually asked to try to have the law keep up with where society is going, because all these changes are happening and you don't want the law to lead the society, but instead you want the law to kind of keep up more or less. And then you have other areas, which is this trust area, in which the folks who do this kind of work actually have an interest in Alaska being at the forefront of kind of the most modern stuff, because that brings opportunities for the state, for investment companies and individuals who set up trusts here. And it's the same way that Delaware for many years has sort of made a point of being ahead in corporate law. So it's amazing the number of corporations that are incorporated in Delaware, but mostly because Delaware has gotten on this cycle of being at the head of the curve for being a good place to for corporations to operate. And so this bill is an instance in which we're trying to make it possible for the Alaska trust law to actually draw more trusts to incorporate here, which will bring opportunities to Alaskans that we wouldn't have if we were kind of in 49th place in terms of sophistication of our trust laws. I, like Representative Ledoux, I'm very struck by the fact that there's no opposition. I was really also struck when the practicing attorney from Faulkner Banfield talked about how she works in this area and how our ability to stay in the top two or three states about these kinds of acts has really helped her business and helped her provide service to Alaskans who are looking for this kind of work. So for all those reasons, I support this bill. And with that, Representative Kopp, may I have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move version 30-LS0770/A of House Bill 208 with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Is there any opposition? Hearing none, House Bill 208 moves from committee. And if you'll just make sure you sign the bill or the paperwork as it circulates through, Representative Fansler, I know, has to go to another hearing. If you could let him sign the paperwork before he goes. Our third order of business today is House Bill 1, Election Registration and Voting, sponsored by Representative Tuck, who is with us today. This is the first hearing of the bill in Judiciary Committee, and here to introduce the bill is Representative Tuck. If the bill sponsor and his staff would please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. Thank you today for hearing House Bill 1. It is very important that every Alaskan has the opportunity to have their voices heard.
Yes.
You could identify yourself. Chris Tuck for the record.
We all know who you are, but the record says.
District 23, South Central Anchorage. And then with me is my staff, Kendra Kloster. And so thanks again for allowing me to present House Bill 1. It is very important that Alaskans have the opportunity to have their voices heard in the election process. And when we exercise our rights to vote, we can also have an impact on our community far beyond the election. We are electing individuals who are representing us and making decisions on everyone's behalf, set policies that guide our state, and vote on issues that impact our community. So House Bill 1 includes a series of changes designed to increase voter participation and access to voting across the state by improving and clarifying the voting process. So basically it does about five things. It provides same-day voter registration to allow all eligible Alaskans the opportunity to vote. It enhances online voter registration with electronic signature to make the registration process quicker and easier. It ensures the same early voting locations are available during every election. And it creates an option for permanent absentee voting for individuals that plan to vote by mail every year. And last, it clarifies and unifies terminology for early voting to remove confusion between early voting and absentee in-person voting. I always thought that was kind of a funny term, whether are you absent or are you in person. So it helps clarify that because people do get confused, and poll workers actually get confused when people try to early vote and they early vote by in-person absentee voting. During the State Affairs Committee hearings, and we had feedback from the Division of Elections. We have included some of the additional changes which we seek to clean up, basically trying to update Title 15 of our statutes. And since they have not been updated since the 1960s, part of the cleanup language is getting our statutes up to date with what the Division of Elections are currently doing. And the past couple months, we have had multiple meetings with Division of Elections and have before you an even better piece of legislation than when we first began. And with that, I would like to turn it over to my staff, Kendra Kloster, if you would like to have the sectional analysis done.
Please.
For the record, Kendra Kloster, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. So, the chair, would you like me to just go through section by section of the bill or the changes? What would
however you want to, it's up, you can choose your sectional analysis as you wish. I'm not inclined to give you direction. We'll get enough questions going soon enough.
All right, sounds good. So I will go through this a little bit section by section as brief as I can. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Reinbold.
I just want to make sure we're on the right one. If we adopted the committee substitute or not, I'm trying to figure out because they're quite different. So
the committee substitute is a State Affairs Committee substitute, so the bill before us is what was adopted by State Affairs, which is, I believe, the U version. Ms. Kloster, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so we don't need to adopt it since that was done before us.
Just wanted to make sure. Okay, thank you very much.
That's a good question. I was starting to ask the same question, and I started looking and answered it in the same way. Go ahead.
So looking at Section 1, this removes language that would require a voter to register before an election within 30 days. So that's with the same-day voter registration. So you can register to vote the same day that you want to register. You still have to live within that district for 30 days, though, just as an FYI, that is in the Constitution. Section 2 is an electronic signature.
Representative Reinbold has a question.
Well, I just want to know, Mr. Chairman, are we going to just let her go through the section, or are we going to ask questions? Because this is quite there's quite a few sections on this bill, and I don't know what the will is of the committee. Are we going to let them go through the sectional, or are we going to ask questions during? Because I have questions on bill section number 1, but I don't know.
Go ahead and ask your question on section 1.
Okay, first of all, can you describe any concerns that you've heard in regards to registering same day, being able to vote same day versus having that 30-day requirement? Do you see any liabilities, any concerns? Have you heard any feedback, any opposition?
If I may, Representative Chris Tuck through the chair. So the only concerns that we had is a little bit on verification, but it's not verification at the time they vote. It's they verify at the time that the ballot is counted, which is very similar to what we have with early voting already, in-person absentee. Those people do vote according to the ballot, and those ballots are always under review prior to being counted.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yeah, I'm just telling you, I've heard quite a bit of opposition in regards to the 30-day versus no requirement for a 30-day election, but I just wanted to know what your office had heard and if there had been any input that you were aware of. But I understand that addresses section number one, but I'm ready to move on unless anybody else has.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative just to clarify, so currently someone can vote in person absentee and change their voter registration within 10 days of the election. That we already have. So what this first section will do was allow someone to do that for the first time voting, as well allow to someone to change their voter registration that they were previously allowed to vote. So when you look at the question ballot or the absentee ballot, on the outside of there, it's a dual purpose. It's your ballot, but it's also any changes that you want to make. So currently we do that already, but this will allow them to vote all the way down the ballot, not just the top of the ballot, for the current election.
Representative Reinbold.
Point of clarification, and I believe you addressed this, but I want to make sure they still had to register 30 days before, but they can change their registration. Is that correct?
Not in this first section, through the chair. This first section requires them to be a resident 30 days beforehand. So the residency requirement is still there. It's in statute. It's also in the Constitution. But this allows someone who has been a resident for longer than 30 days to be able to vote up to the same day election, same day of the election. Register to vote and vote up to the same day of the election.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Tuck, a couple of questions. So first, jurisdiction here. When we say jurisdiction, page 2, line 2, are we talking another state or country for that matter? We're not talking a different house district or something like that, are we?
Okay, and that's actually existing language in our statutes. AS 1507 is not registered to vote in another jurisdiction outside the state of Alaska.
Okay. Follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm interested to make sure that we don't confuse voters or potential voters. And I understand on line 2 where it talks about jurisdiction, it says is not registered to vote in another jurisdiction. Is there a mechanism by which someone who is registered or has registered at least at some point in their life before this particular day can unregister? Because if we're announcing to Alaskans that they can register without, you know, waiting the 30 days now, I'd hate for somebody to show up and want to vote, but then this language that says that they can't have registered to vote previously keep them from being able to vote.
Thank you for the question, through the chair. We do, I believe we have people in the audience behind me from the Division of Elections to find out how they currently do that. I know that we recently, last year, got into the ERIC system, which is a way of verifying people's voter registration from other states. But the question that I believe I heard you state is whether or not someone can unregister from somewhere to make sure that they're not in violation of this statute. So if I may...
Kendra Kloster, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. When you register in Alaska, on your form it asks if you are registered in another state. And so when you are re-registering, you're going to mark if you are registered in another state. And so you will be taken off the voter rolls in the other state where you may have previously voted. And so you're able to then vote in Alaska, so you're not under two jurisdictions. And that's what we do currently. And right now for voting, you have to live within the state for 30 days, and that's in our Constitution in order to vote in the election. You can currently right now vote top of the ticket, so vote for president. However, what this for our same-day voter registration, we're saying you can vote down ballot, but it's still not changing that 30-day mark that you have to live in the state or within that district that you're voting in.
Follow-up?
Representative Eastman, follow-up.
All right, so from what I understand, the registration and unregistration is automatic, you know, on the day that you're filling out the form, which in this case could be the day of the election. So I'm wondering if that's the case, why we're choosing to maintain this language about not being registered, because as I look at the statute and it says, you know, you can do this as long as you're not registered, that sort of cues me in the idea that the unregistration isn't automatic or that isn't taking place fast enough for me to be able to vote and unregister and register all on the same day.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I would like the division to come up and maybe they can address that a little bit more to clarify your question. But, you know, right now they do want to make sure that you're not voting in two different states. And so within the 30-day mark, you have to vote a question ballot, which is what the bill also says in multiple times. So if you're voting, if you're registering to vote and vote within that 30-day mark, you're going to vote a question ballot. And then it's subject to review by the division to make sure that you're an eligible voter before your vote is actually counted.
And we won't bring up Division of Elections till they get through their sectional analysis. Just remember your question. We can bring them up later. I don't see other questions, so go ahead and proceed.
Okay, moving on to Section 2. This adds an electronic signature. And this is what we're looking at is maybe something like Alaska, where you can type in your name, how we register for permanent fund. That's kind of the way that we are looking at this. Section 3 instructs the director or the division director for a new definition of electronic signature. This was put in by request of the division to make sure that they can have a definition for the electronic signature that will work best for them. Section 4 allows a qualified voter to register on the same day of the election or within 30 days. Section 5 amends a section referring to the voter certificate located on the absentee ballot, which this is something we currently do right now in the Division of Elections. So if you're filling out your information, you can already change your party affiliation. So this was updating that information on what the division already proceeds with. And we also added in a special needs ballot, which moves into Section 6, making sure that the absentee or question ballot includes a special needs ballot as well under that definition. Section 7 clarifies that a voter who registers or re-registers will vote a question ballot, and this was kind of the process I was just referring to when we were talking about Section 1 to make sure that they are qualified voters, and so they'll vote a question ballot, which will then be reviewed. Section 9, this is some cleanup language, again, referring to voting absentee or a question ballot. Section 10, again, same thing. Section 11, this is where we get into changing the terminology for early voting rather than absentee or absentee in-person voting, just making it more clear to the public.
Representative Reinbold has a question.
You're going a little fast here. I mean, I appreciate the fact that you have great knowledge of this, but if you could just go back just a little bit to Section 10 and once again explain Section 11, I would really appreciate it. And I don't even mind if you talk about the new language allowing question voter to by question valid or absentee valid, if you just talk about that. These are kind of big issues that have brought nationwide attention. And just making sure the people that are listening as well are able to follow and understand exactly what you're talking about.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Reinbold, through the chair. So when we're looking at one of the changes, right now the terminology that we use is absentee or absentee in-person voting. So when you're going to the ballot or you're going to an absentee in-person vote, which is your early voting 2 weeks before the election, there was some confusion amongst a lot of people of what actually absentee in-person voting is, and really what it is, it's early voting. You can early vote. So what we did is just changing the terminology to say it's all called early voting. So it's trying to change the terminology so when we're telling the public, oh, you can go early vote, rather than calling it absentee in-person voting, because that has been confusing to some individuals of saying, what do you mean? Is it absentee or is it in-person voting?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ryan.
Can I just point a clarification? Okay, so basically what you're trying to do in Section 11 is if you absentee vote by mail or if you actually go to an early voting station and vote in person but you vote early, you're calling all of that early voting. Is that correct?
Representative Reinbold through the chair, that's correct.
Okay.
We are not changing any of the procedures within the Division of Elections. We're just changing what we call it. So that way when we tell voters that you can early vote, we're calling it early vote across the board. And so we're not changing the procedures on how they address their absentee ballots or their absentee in-person ballots, but what we're trying to do is just say, to the public and make it more clear that you can go ahead and you can early vote.
So can I ask one question? I know there's, but I'm looking at page four, and I understand you're working to change the terminology to early voting and do away with absentee voting. But I look up the page and I see absentee voting listed three or four times, and I'm just I guess my question is, if we're trying to call it all early voting, why do we still keep calling it absentee voting?
That's a very good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think a lot of it is because of existing statutes that we have right now. But like Section 9 is basically the person who claims to be a registered voter but not for whom no evidence of registration of the precinct can be found shall vote in absentee or question ballot. That's internal. And the reason why that's that way is so that a verification can happen after the person votes and prior to the ballot being counted. So that's internal process, so that's not really in concern to the public. And just to back up a little bit with Representative Reinbold's question, is that we only, in the state of Alaska, we really only have six actual early voting locations. And that's where they can verify where you live right then and there and give you your exact precinct that you live in, and you can vote, and your vote will be counted without any question. When you go into absentee in person, which you can do up to 15 days before the election, there's 181 locations of those. But in the 2014 election, there was discovered that many people were turned away because they said, well, you can't vote absentee because you're here. When actually, yes, it's just an in-person absentee ballot. And so we're just trying to clarify and trying to clean up any confusion that might be out there in the public. So you will still see absentee and question ballots being through the statutes, but we'll get to the sections here which help clarifies where we clarify in actually calling it early voting.
Representative Reinbold, follow-up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is actually jumping back up to the question ballot or absentee ballot. I just want you guys to drill down in regards to section number 9 in regards to what your goal is by changing the language there.
The goal on that one, through the chair, is allowing someone to vote in absentee or question ballot. Because right now there might not be any evidence of where the person resides, so then they can verify that later. On the outside, the envelope is where they fill out all that information. So that way they can go ahead and vote that absentee or question ballot and not have to do anything other than that. Verification comes when it's necessary to count that ballot. So it's just clarifying.
Representative Ledoux.
Is there any reason why they do it the way they do it now? Because, quite frankly, I've always been confused myself, and I'm not sure I'm any less confused now, except that I think it's trying to make it all consistent, which is a good thing. But has the division perhaps shared with you why they do it in what seems to me a somewhat convoluted, arcane way right now with the idea of early voting and then absentee in-person voting?
Well, I think it's an evolutionary process. We allowed people in the beginning, early on, to vote absentee. And that's because they weren't going to be able to make it to their polling locations or they were out of state. And then we said, okay, well, how about for those people that want to be able to vote in the convenience of their home? And so then it was absentee voting is also considered a mail ballot. And then we decided to open up locations for people to early vote when the election booths aren't really election booths yet. And so then we allowed them to do in-person absentee voting. So it's kind of the way that things evolve. What we plan on doing, what we're hoping to do with this bill, is to have consistency throughout. Because then we also have special needs voting. We have other voting methods that we're going to keep consistent with all other methods. So this is turned into a big cleanup bill, if you will, for Title 15.
Clear as mud.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead. Continue.
I believe we're in Section 12 now. Sorry to find my place again. This clarifies the privileges of poll watchers. So right now this is kind of bringing our statutes up to date on what we are currently doing, allowing individuals to come in while their people are voting and having people there to watch what's going on. So this is clarifying it. One place that we're changing is an initiative or referendum. We're changing that to a ballot proposition because that includes both of them. And again, over on page 6, which is this is still part of section 12, allowing one or more persons being a poll watcher, whether it's for the candidate, a group, or an organization. So again, this is something that the division already allows to do. We're trying to bring our statutes up to date since they were, you know, as mentioned, from the 1960s. So this is something that they already do, and we just want to clarify in statute.
No question.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I'm curious, and looking at not only the changes, but sort of how this current section currently reads, do you know what the definition of party is for this section? Is it the same as our statewide definition of what constitutes a party? So you have to have so many voters and percents, whatnot? Because we're talking about precinct level. It certainly would seem to me you could have a precinct where, you know, 90-100% of the precinct belongs to some party that's not actually big enough to be a statewide party. But I don't think under the current language they would qualify to get a poll watcher because they're not one of the big statewide major parties.
And Representative Eastman, through the chair, it's the same. We're not changing the definition, but I do want to say that in here it's saying that a candidate, too, so any candidate that may have mm-hmm. someone will be able to have someone. And when I was talking with the division, when we were going through this, they were like, well, we don't really turn away people that want to come and poll watch. So that's their current practice now. If someone wants to be there, that they are allowed to be there to poll watch. And they haven't run into any issues at this point. But we just wanted to make sure and clarify that anyone that is running and they want to be there, whether it be a ballot proposition or a candidate that's running, no matter if it's what party they're in, they can have someone there.
Follow-up?
Representative Eastman,
follow-up. And is it your understanding then that a group who wasn't large enough to be a party could qualify into this language, or is that just their being nice and letting them have a poll watcher?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, we envision that this is actually inclusive of everyone, of any group could have
Thank
someone
you.
There.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I would like to point out that despite what the Division of Elections might have told you, I've actually been in the situation where I've wanted to have a poll watcher in a primary election many, many moons ago. And it was in a general election many moons ago, and the division wouldn't let me have an individual poll watcher. They wanted to leave that totally to the party. So this kind of, if this is what the division is doing now, which I think is a good thing, no point, it's a good idea to clarify it.
Get some clarity instead of mud.
Exactly, and that's one of the good reasons for putting it in the bill, is making sure that what they do now or supposed to do is will be within the statute, so hopefully we won't have issues like that in the future.
Follow-up? Representative Eastman.
Follow-up, going back to the earlier question. Page 5, line 7 talks about distinguishing candidates who do represent a political party from candidates who don't. And if the idea is to be inclusive to all candidates, maybe we could look at removing that limiting language.
Okay.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, one of the things that we don't want to happen is just that any public member come in. And so so we have it to so that we have a precinct party committee, we have organized precinct committee exists, or party district committee, whether no organized precinct committee exists, or state party. Then we go down to make sure that and this is all actually existing language, it's just mostly cleaning up, and then we go down a little bit further on that
the next page is where we allow it to be opened up for others. But I think it is all inclusive. The only thing that's not inclusive is just anyone who wants to be a poll watcher that's not sanctioned by a party or a candidate or a ballot initiative or one way or the other. So it almost opens it up to just anyone who wants to be a poll watcher, almost, but not quite there.
Okay. You can continue.
Sorry.
Actually, I have a comment. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Representative Reinbold.
I really wanted to make a comment on this issue earlier, but if you guys don't mind your office providing us the exact what it does versus the comparison, you know, of what you're changing it to, I think that would be really helpful. I have a lot of people in my district that are asking me about this right now. What is it currently versus what it's changing to? And and I know we went over to high level, If it's opening up to almost anybody, is I believe what you just said, that wants to be a poll watcher, is that what you just said? Through the chair?
Yes, through the chair. Yes, I said that, but it's not like any – there is conditions in here. But basically, the candidates any organization or organized group that sponsors or opposes a ballot proposition or recall may have one or more watchers at the polls and counting centers for the first – but then we also have it for each individual candidates instead of just the parties. So,
and Representative Reinbold, actually, and part of your question was, what is it today? What is it today? You can see because they've got the language in block letters that is being removed. So what's being removed is what it is today, and they're proposing the change. So I think you actually have the information you're asking about. How is it being changed from existing statute?
And Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, but I need to email out to people who are requiring, and I'm happy to do that, but it's just sometimes they have a little bit of hard time with the underlying, with the brackets, with this, with that, with this version, with that version. But it's something I can do, but I just thought maybe other people may be asking for it as well.
And Representative Reinbold, through the chair, I do have something that I've typed up which tells me kind of what each section does in like one line. So if that might be helpful, I can send that to you, and if you want additional information, happy to work with you and get what you need. And one of the things, too, with this section is, you know, we wanted to make sure when talking with the vision that we didn't let a whole bunch of people in there into the poll watching, because one of the things is you have to keep that area clear to make sure people can go in, they can vote at the same time, and making sure that's not as confusion for the individual that are there while still allowing organizations that are doing ballot propositions or candidates having someone there and available. So while trying to open it up but not open it up too much, we want to, you know, so you don't have the whole place flooded with individuals and make that place, make the voting area hard to get in and out of.
And that is my exact concern, so I really appreciate that. And it was just like we did our own sectional analysis on this bill, and this section was flagged as major changes. And so that's why and also I have several people in my district that have been doing this for a long, long, long time that really want a very thorough explanation, especially in regards to Section 12 and 13. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at page 5, line 16. I noticed there's some language being removed dealing with citizenship requirements. I don't see that coming back up anywhere else in the immediate area. Is there a concern, then, that we're not allowing enough foreign poll watchers at our polling places, or what's driving that change?
If you look at Section 13, which we're going to get to here in just a second, we're just reorganizing Title 15 to make sure that it reads well.
Perfect.
And you'll find on line 17 on page 6, starting line 17, state party, organization, organized group, or candidate, a watcher must be a United States citizen. So, no, it's not our intent. This is a cleanup bill. So, things are going to be moved as things are going to be placed properly.
Representative Eastman, sometimes there's the sense that we start with a bill and people start thinking of amendments to try to make it bigger and better, and try to make a small bill into a big bill. And this was an instance, apparently, when they started with a small bill, they started far enough ago that somebody decided to make it into a big bill before it could get to us.
Now lots to go over. Thank you.
You can continue.
So Section 13 is actually, President Easton brought us to that, where the out of Section 12, we saw a lot of that language being deleted, actually being put into Section 13 now. So again, with moving things around. So Section 14, this is one of the added changes by the division when we were doing same-day voter registration, is adding on a declaration. So what you may sign when you're registering to vote, saying your information is true and accurate, we are putting this on our question ballot procedures as well. So you'll vote, you'll put your envelope on, and we'll have that same declaration of saying the information that I provide is true and accurate. Section 15, 16, and 17 is actually all relating to the declaration that we had, that the Division of Elections had requested that we have put that on their, on all of our question ballots. So that all of those sections are referring to that. Section 18 gets to an issue that we had talked about before of changing the terminology of early voting and trying to make it more clear for the public to understand. We also went into a designation of an early voting station. So a few years ago, back in, I believe it was 2014, there was an effort by a number of organizations, Get Out the Native Vote, AFN, to put out early voting stations in a number of our rural areas so that everyone has access to early voting. And so under this section, what we said is to keep those early voting stations that we set up same and consistent every single year, so every Alaskan has the opportunity to early vote and not just in our larger areas. Section 19, again, early voting terminology update. Again, that is also for Section 20 and 21. And 22. And Section 23, this allows for voter registration updates. Currently, when you are voting and you're putting in your information, like Representative Tuck had mentioned before, you can update your voter registration on the day that you are voting. However, currently, your voter registration is not updated if you were to vote by fax or vote by email. And this was one of the cleanup areas that the division had pointed out that they wanted to be able to do. So if you vote by email, all of your information is updated via email and via fax. That's just something that they hadn't had a chance to update. So that was added into this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Reinbold.
Not to push you back, but section number 15, it's bill section 21, but it goes into section 15.2.060. If you could just focus, it's almost an entire page, and we kind of jumped through that pretty quickly. Is there any major changes in the bill section 21? It actually is a whole new subsection. I see that, but what is the change from what we're doing now to what you're trying to achieve here?
Representative Rambo, through the chair again. Sorry, which sections were you looking at?
Bill section 21.
21. Mm-hmm. Oh, section 21 is, so 1520.064 is related to early voting. So if a voter's eligibility to vote cannot be verified at that time, then what we're asking is them to vote an absentee question ballot, which means that if they cannot verify that they're the voter right there, they would vote that question ballot. Then it goes through an additional review process by the division to ensure that they're eligible before the vote is counted.
And how is, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
How is that different from than what we're doing right now?
Representative Reinbold, through the chair, it's additional clarification language. When we did a lot of our same-day voter registration changes throughout the bill, we wanted to clarify that if you are voting a question ballot, we wanted to put it in statute to say that this is the process that you follow. No matter right now, if you vote a question ballot, it still goes through that same review process. However, as we're cleaning up our statutes and putting information regarding same-day voter registration for our early voting, we want to make sure and clarify that if you do vote a question or absentee ballot, that it goes through that review process. So even if you vote now via question ballot, it's going to go through that process, but we're in the votes of cleaning it up. And I know the division is back here wanting to add more to that, too, so I'll let them.
Maybe that's
when we're done with the section, I'll let them on there, too.
This is in regard to the section?
Yeah. Go ahead and ask your question.
Okay, so in regards to Section 21, and I understand now that it is because of it's the same day, where my concern is that the results of the election may be, you know, delayed. Because normally if they have to do a 30-day registration, then they've got that 30 days to provide and validate the information. Well, now if it's same day and then they have to count that vote, I'm just concerned that this might delay the results of the election. I'm not sure if you guys have addressed that or not, but I would definitely like you to weigh in regards to that.
And Representative Reinbold, through the chair, I think the division would have some good information on that too, but one of the recent things that we did is a PFD voter initiative. So when you sign up for your PFD, you actually be registered to vote. So I don't think that this will have as huge an impact as it may have a few years ago, as a lot more people will now be registered to vote when they sign up for their permanent fund. So that's also something to keep in mind.
And if we may, Mr. Chair, can we go ahead and continue through the sectional analysis,
and then we'll have
Division of Election clarify all this stuff.
It seems like we're starting to get into a number of questions that are going to be more division questions. I actually see, though, we're fairly close. We're at Section 21, and we only have about nine left. So let's see if we can get through the sectional, and we'll get some other folks up. Go ahead.
Okay, just finding my place.
We're at Section 22, I think.
So I went through, I believe Section 22 was the changing terminology to early voting. Section 23 was something that I had mentioned about updating your voter registration via email and fax. And Section 24 is a new subsection. Let's see. So for our current absentee ballot, what we are doing is if you want to get an absentee ballot every year, you have to fill out an application. What we're asking now is to have a permanent absentee voting. So when you sign up, you can say, I want to receive an absentee ballot to my house every single year without having to apply. So it'll continue to be sent to your home. However, there are a couple conditions. If mail is returned, you will fall off that list of receiving an absentee ballot, and you have to continue voting. So if you don't vote within 4 years, your absentee ballot will not be continued to send to you, so you'd have to re-sign up if you want to participate. And you do not fall off the voter rolls at all. Just want to make that clear. That was a question before. Section 25. This was so for an absentee in-person, special, or question ballot, this is during the primary election, that the voter certificate appears on the envelope, and this was the same thing that we had done kind of in the general. So if you have a certificate signing that the information is true and correct. Section 26 is a definition for the electronic signature, which refers to AS 9.80.190, something we already have in statute.
Question? Representative Eastman, question.
So going back a couple lines to Section 25 through the chair. Now, I see we've still got the 30th day references in lines 11 and 12 as designating an individual's party. But then farther down the next few lines, it seems to me like we're saying that, you know, if they change their party, then it's the new party that kicks in. And I'm wondering why we need to designate both that it's whatever party they are on election day, and then also it's whatever party is at the 30th day. I mean, if that is that language required in order to, you know, tell the division what absentee ballots to mail, or what's the significance of keeping kind of those two contradictory pieces of language?
And if I will make an attempt at that, Mr. Chair, this is Representative Chris Tuck. So, yes, currently right now the language is 30 days before the primary election. And then we have this condition. If, however, a voter changes party affiliation with 30 days, then the voter shall vote in absentee in-person special needs or question ballot at the primary election with the voter's new party. The reason why this was put in there is that as I was explaining earlier, that within 10 days of the election, you can change your party registration as you vote, as your early vote. So this was added in there to keep everything consistent up to the same day voting, because you can use that ballot envelope as updating any information that you want to update
including changing party affiliation. So this was added in there as somewhat of a cleanup. And why they drafted this way is a good question. We might have to bring Ledge Legal in on this a little bit later.
Thank you.
And I just want to note, as we're getting closer to the end of the section, we do have some people online that want to testify. And we, sooner we get through the section, the sooner we can get the testimony. All right. Any questions now?
I do.
All right. Representative Reinbold,
go
ahead.
I'm just going to say I'll be happy to talk to your office, but I definitely have concerns about Section 25. We'll talk. Since he wants to get to public testimony, I'll come by and talk to you, and then happy to get it on the record, but I just want to let you know.
Go ahead.
Section 27 is also referring to the early voting change in terminology. Section 28 is conforming language for the same-day voter registration. Section 29, we are repealing some information that deals with the same-day voter registration of a 30-day requirement. And then you get into Section 30, which is your provision regulatory language, and Section 31, your effective date.
We on the U version?
Yes.
I only have 30 sections in the U version. Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. I misread. Apologize. Take it all back. Okay. Any follow-up questions before we go to public testimony? I'm going to go and thank you very much for that detailed sectional analysis and responding to questions as we go forward. I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 1. First, is there anyone in the room who wishes to provide public testimony on House Bill 1? Hearing and seeing no one, we do have one person on the calendar, or actually more than one. First, we have Eugene Haberman, who's calling in for the second time today, or maybe he's just stayed on the line the whole time from the Matsu LIO. Mr. Haberman, if you would state your name and any affiliation.
My name is Eugene Carl Haberman. I represent myself. I live in the Matsu Valley. I follow the public process. The process and a appropriate decision made by the governing body is more likely in the public interest.
Can you slow down a little bit, please?
Yeah, but you give me a limited amount of time for the record. You can take my comments I said on House Bill 200, and they reflect they should be added. Please add them to the dealing with HB 1. I was listening attentively to the questions on this House Bill 1, and I couldn't help but notice the word poll watcher. Now, I was concerned. Principal concern is what happens after the election closes and they're dealing with the ballots. I'm denied my right to be an observer, to observe the counting of the ballots, verifying the ballots, whether they are legit or not, before they open up the envelopes and so forth. That's what I'm talking about. I wasn't talking about poll watchers, but that's another story. I'm talking about the counting of the ballots. I should also like to note also this, and this deals with elections, and I'm not off topic. Recently, I'm just going to compare it to what's going on in Anchorage. Recently, something changed. I was at the canvas meeting for Anchorage last night. Now, in the past, when they would send letters out, Anchorage would send letters out. If they rejected their ballot envelope, and they had an opportunity to appeal. Well, last night was the first time I've seen a situation which they did not provide that opportunity. Now, this is what goes on at the state level. And where you should also be concerned is you are aware of the low voter turnout that's happening in the local elections and state elections. But you're also aware that there are many parts of that election where you have occasions where there are very few vote differences in who is winning the election and who's not going to win the election. When you do not have an opportunity for a party to be told beforehand that their ballot is not going to be counted and their right to appeal and go for, like, for instance, in Anchorage's case, the Election Commission, you create a situation that's clear that, where I would say the election is illegitimate, and that's what's going on the state level. And I would also remind you of what happened in the last election for the state in the primary. As you know, there was a court proceeding. I did observe the court proceeding, most of it, and also the Supreme Court. What stood out also in that whole thing was you had the head of elections going on the record and saying that she's going to do on-the-job training. You don't put someone in charge of the elections that's learning on the job. So whatever bill you're pushing through, the fact is the lack of education of the party responsible of state election leads to a situation where the legitimacy cannot be shown to be valid. My time's up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Haberman. I think Representative Reingold has a question for you.
I thank you for your testimony, and I definitely would like to get it in writing. And if you could restate your name, and I don't know if you're testifying for anything else, but I was quite impressed with some of your knowledge. I want to make sure that your concerns are addressed. So if you could email through Rep. Klayman or any of us members your testimony, that would be great.
And it's Eugene Haberman, H-A-B-E-R-M-A-N. First name Eugene, and his middle name is Carl with a C.
Yeah,
Representative Eastman has a question.
Yes, thank you very much, Eugene. I just wanted to give you a quick comment in response that I appreciate the concern with regards to having someone's vote not counted and having no opportunity to appeal. And if that is the case in our current state law, then you know perhaps that's something we need to look at. I happen to know individuals, in fact, candidates who ran in the last election who got that letter in the mail afterwards, and the election division told them that their vote didn't count, and when they tried to figure out why, the election division couldn't tell them because they couldn't find any reason why they would have not let them vote. So I just do know that we are hearing your concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. Thank you, Mr. Haberman. The next on the list for public testimony is Michael Hawfield. Mr. Hawfield calling from Homer, or the Homer LIO. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Proceed with your testimony, stating your name and any affiliation you may have.
My name is Michael Hawfield, and I don't have a specific affiliation. I'm representing myself, and I want to state that I appreciate Mr. Haberman's concerns. This is the first time I've heard them, but I agree with those concerns, and I look forward to Representative Chris Tuck pursuing some of those issues that he brought up. I think that would be helpful. But I wanted basically just to assert affirm my strong support for HB 1. In the last election, for instance, I was active in trying to help a lot of new voters to figure out how things worked, and particularly those who wanted to vote early and didn't know much about registration. And I think this effort to clarify, streamline the whole process of registration, and especially early voting, is very important. There's just so many younger people who get turned off to the whole process of voting that it's a significant part of the depression of voter response in our elections. And I think it's the sanctity of our elections is paramount. And I applaud the work by Representative Tuck in creating a bill that I think will help immensely. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a couple of other people that are listed, but they're all for questions. There's Carol Thompson from Division of Elections and Lori Wilson, who's here in the room from Division of Elections. And I have no one else online. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify as to House Bill 1? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to close the public testimony. That brings us up to some further discussion. And this is also an opportunity. Actually, why don't we bring somebody up from Division of Elections now to answer questions? I'm not sure. I guess that's going to be Lori Wilson. I think that's Lori. You're not Lori Wilson. Okay. Well, let us know who you are since we apparently don't.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carol Thompson. I'm the absentee and petition manager for the Division of Elections.
Are you the person ahead at the bottom of the list? Okay. Go ahead.
I was trying to be last.
Well, we were trying to accommodate that. I'll just ask the general question. What is the division's perspective with regard to the bill and position? And then I know there were some questions that I think are you best answer. And if you remember what you think those concerns are, you can address them, or we can just let people ask questions.
We can just open that up, Mr. Chairman. If we can just open that up to questions, that would be fine.
Okay. Let me just ask, does the administration support this bill?
I don't know if I should address that, okay. As that would be up to the Director of Elections.
Okay, but at this point, you're not prepared to provide where the... Okay, that's the answer.
Thank you, sir.
Who has questions for the Division of Elections? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, one of the questions that arose goes back to the top portions of page 2 of the bill. And if you've had a chance to do some analysis, I was curious why we are keeping line 2 as is, and it refers to the fact that as required under AS 1507 and is not registered to vote in another jurisdiction. And is it your analysis that this bill provides for automatic unregistration in another jurisdiction as soon as you are registering? Is that relatively instantaneous? And if that is the case, why do we still have this stipulation that they can't be registered somewhere else?
Representative Eastman, through the chair. Currently, as voter registration exists today, you have to be registered 30 days prior to an election. So this bill, or this particular line on page 2, is speaking to the fact that a person cannot be registered to vote in another jurisdiction or another state. So in this case, people would have been able to notify those states of their cancellation. They could do that through our voter registration application, or they could contact the state itself and request cancellation. As far as the intention of the sponsor's bill at this point, how that would be addressed at the same-day registration level would have to be determined. For right at this point, a person who is not on the precinct register, if they go to a polling place on election day and vote a question ballot, that particular question, are you registered in another state, is not on that particular envelope, and so that would have to be addressed in some manner. Through the sponsor's bill.
Follow-up. So currently it's not a question on the envelope, but the language is current. I mean, this isn't new language that the sponsor's bill is adding. That's currently the language, and I'm wondering if there's a discrepancy there.
Well, correct. Representative Eastman, through the chair, correct. And at this point, we don't have the question, but it is part of the voter oath at the bottom, the declaration that they are not registered to vote in any other district or any other state or jurisdiction, and that they'll take the necessary steps to cancel that registration. So it's actually in the declaration on the envelope itself.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Representative Ledoux.
Yes, well, I guess I'd like to point out, when you say that currently you need to be registered within 30 days, that that does not apply, it's my understanding, to presidential elections. And so, therefore, if there's any language or anything that needs to be do to unregister oneself from another jurisdiction, that either presumably is being done now by the Division of Elections, or presumably should be done by the Division of Elections, or hopefully this bill can take care of it.
Sounds like that was a comment and not a question. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for the Division. Sections 1 and 8 of the bill address, you know, voting in a House district, 1 indirectly and 8 directly. My question is can you vote the down ballot? Like, say, can you vote for a House district representative having just moved into the House district that same day?
Representative Kopp, through the chair, currently how a question ballot is handled in the state is a person would go to your polling place on election day, and they would be looked upon the precinct register. If their name does not appear on that register, then they are afforded the opportunity to vote the question ballot. Or if they have indicated they no longer live in that particular district, they are afforded an opportunity to vote a question ballot. On the question ballot envelope itself, it allows the voter to put their current address. When they when those question ballots come back from the polling place to the division, we do a review of the database system as to where they were registered 30 days prior to the election day versus what they are now registering at on that current application form that's on the question ballot envelope. If there is a conflict of districts, then we do not count the House district portion, and we work our way up. So we would start with the House district. Are they registered in the same Senate district? If they're registered in the same Senate district, we would count that race. If they're not registered in the House and the Senate, then we would count all the statewide races.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Representative Kopp, follow up.
So is it the law now that you have to be registered in a House district for 30 days or more to vote that particular seat on the ballot?
Representative Kopp, through the chair, correct.
Okay. And one more question, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Representative.
So last year we had a significant elections reform bill go through Senate Bill 9, which I carried. And so my question for the division was, part of that was to encourage voter notification and updating our voter registration rolls through a ability to partner with a nonprofit cooperative efforts led by states rather than the government, the federal government. And it has that been implemented?
Representative Kopp, through the chair, we have done one outreach in 2016 using the ERIC program. So, yes, we are working on that process more so this year. We did do outreach to all unregistered voters in 2016, letting them know they can register to vote. And then now this year we'll be also working to match our list against other state lists to see if we have people who may be registered in more than one state and continuing to work that process.
Thank you. And just to clarify, Mr. Chairman, I didn't carry the bill. It was Senator Majicki. I was just a good staff person. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Ledoux.
So do I understand now, would my understanding be correct, that if somebody moved to House District A from House District B and they had not changed their registration until they got to the polls, and so they go to the polls and they change their registration, that they can, or they do it through an absentee ballot, which they've gotten, and then they, which they got maybe when they were in House District B, but then they vote it when they're in House District A, and so they indicate a different address on House, that they've changed their address, that their vote for neither House District B or House District A counts. Is that correct?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, well, voters would only have one ballot, so depending on which one they would have, we would look and see as to which House district they resided in and compare it with the House district they voted, and if they were not registered in the same House district as the ballot, then no, that portion of the ballot would not count. It's considered a partially counted ballot.
But what I'm talking about is, okay, so you've got your ballot, and you got your ballot before you moved, but you haven't voted your ballot. So now it's election day, and you don't want to go to the polls. Instead, you want to vote this ballot that you've lugged from, you know, your old house in District B to your new house in District A. So you fill out this form, and this form has all of the candidates for, you know, the statewide, and then the Senate, and then House District B. But now you have put down on your absentee ballot your affirmation of your address. And when you look at the address, you say, oh, this person is no longer living in House District B. They're living in House District A. I'm going to assume that that ballot for where they may have voted for the candidate who's running in House District, I'm getting it confused, B, you know, now that they're showing an address in House District A, that it doesn't count. Am I correct? That's as clear as I do.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, there are different, so if you're talking about a person who requests an absentee ballot by mail, they submit their absentee ballot application has to come first. We get that application, we process that application, and that application does ask them what their residence address is. Based upon that residence address, that's what ballot they are sent. So when that goes to them, they just get the ballot and the envelope that has the signature and the witnessing and the identifier requirements. In that case, if they were registered in their district 30 days before the election, and that's the residence address we have on file, and that's the ballot we sent to them, then that ballot would be counted in full. But if the person provided us with their application after the 30-day registration deadline, they gave us a different residence address, or they gave us a new residence address, we would send them that ballot for that district. However, it would not count because they did not register in the district in time.
Okay, can I just have a follow-up?
Yeah, but I just want to ask one follow-up on that. But if in fact, under this proposal that Representative Tuck has brought forward, House Bill 1, the person who lived in Representative Ledoux's district 30 days before but then moves to my district 15 days before and gets an early ballot in the mail listing the address in my district, under this bill, you would send them the ballot for the new district because they would get re-registered in the new district and they would get the ballot for my district and get to vote in my district. Am I getting that right, or did I get it so confused that it's getting worse?
Representative Klayman, okay, so I have to visualize this. So, and this is the first time I've ever testified, so be patient with me. So if you are... my intention of this bill is to allow for same-day registration so long as you have been a resident of the district for 30 days. So there would have to be some type of process, perhaps, that the sponsors would need to be considered, or there have to be some kind of notification in the envelope itself that says I've been a resident of the district for 30 days. So you still come back to that 30-day requirement of being a resident in the district to be able to determine whether or not you would be eligible to vote that House district ballot or that Senate district ballot.
Okay. Representative Ledoux, I apologize for jumping in, but go ahead.
Okay. My recollection is that when I voted an absentee ballot, it asks for my address somewhere.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, when you're voting if you're talking about absentee by mail ballot, once you get your ballot, no, there's no question on there as to what your residence address is. You're simply signing it, having it witnessed, and having to provide an identifier. Under state law, those three items are required. You have to apply first to receive the ballot, which is where the application states you have to provide a residence address.
If I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the scenario that you presented,
me or Representative Ledoux? There's a lot of scenarios floating around.
Chair Klayman, when you said that someone moved into your district and is voting by mail, that would be an absentee ballot, and that ballot would be for Ledoux's district, even though they're living in your district, because the requirement still is that they live in your district within 30 days. So they're not going to change or even know to change the ballot to your district, and not until you change your voter registration to that district will you be able to vote in that district, as long as it's been prior to 30 days of living in that area.
All right. Any follow-up? I see Representative Reinbold. Any follow-up, Representative Ledoux? Representative Reinbold.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had a 3:00 and it's 3:10, and I really care about this issue a lot, as many people do. It's one of the most important things to ensure public trust, is that people have the opportunity to vote, in addition to trust the results, and hopefully even trust the candidates, the same candidate they were before the election versus once they come down to this institution. But neither here nor there, I have many questions, and I was wondering if the division will be available tomorrow. Are we hearing this bill again tomorrow?
We haven't decided whether. I hadn't planned to put it on the calendar for tomorrow at this point. I don't believe it's on the calendar.
When the next time we hear it, is the division going to be available?
I'm sure the division will be available the next time we hear the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and also through the chair. On a slightly different topic for a moment, to the director, or to the division. Now, page 5, and this came up earlier as well, my reading of page 5, which is 15.10.170, is that if you're a member of a ballot group, you get a poll watcher. If you are a member of a party, you get a poll watcher. If you're a candidate, in certain circumstances, you get a poll watcher. But if you are a member of a group trying to become a party, you don't. And I'm wondering if the division interprets this statute that way.
Representative Eastman, through the chair. The way I interpret it, the way we interpret this, is that it does allow for a person who is not a maybe with a small minor party, who's not, we consider those political groups. So in here it does talk about a party precinct committee where an organized precinct committee consists, or a party district committee where no organized precinct committee exists. So that would be the state party chair, where that would be the recognized political parties of the state of Alaska, which are there four recognized parties at this time: the Democrat, Republican, Alaska Independent, and the Libertarian. And then it says where neither a precinct nor district party exists, they can appoint watchers. Then it also allows for a candidate not representing a political party may appoint one or more watchers for each precinct or counting center in the candidate's respective district or the state. So a candidate not representing, so that would be any other candidate that appears, basically, on the ballot, to allow them to have one watcher.
Follow up through the chair.
Representative Eastman.
So that's good information, but it doesn't quite go to the situation I'm dealing with. So let's just say the Veterans Party, not a recognized party.
Correct.
They don't have candidates in all the different precincts and districts. In fact, probably most districts they wouldn't necessarily have one, history being what it is. So in the precinct or district where they don't have a candidate to grab a poll watcher from, and they're not a member of a state party to get a poll watcher from, how do they get a poll watcher, or is the intent that they not have one?
Well, it's been quite a while since I have actually worked with poll watchers in all levels, because I've worked with just the actual recognized political parties. But it does say political party, not a candidate not representing a political party. So this would be a political group, and a political group has not met political party status.
Correct.
So I think they would fall under that.
Okay. Follow up to the chair.
Representative Eastman, follow up.
I would have thought the same, but here in a couple places in this statute, as soon as we start talking about groups, we specifically limit the group that's getting a poll watcher to a group that is dealing with a ballot measure, for example. And if they're not, if they don't have that caveat, then I don't think they qualify. That's my reading of the language here.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, perhaps this would be an opportunity for the sponsors of the bill to be able to add in specifically political groups.
Okay, just a thought. Yeah, thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chair. Representative Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only way that a political group would have a poll watcher is if, for example, with the veterans group, is if they had a candidate in that district, so they can have someone in that district. But to have poll watchers outside of that district, they would have to have someone at a higher level, state candidate, statewide candidate, or even a Senate if they just want to look at poll watchers. But I believe Representative Eastman's correct that there is a limit. And again, it's to prevent all these poll watchers that necessarily don't have an effect or don't have a candidate in that election However, if the Veterans Party does, if there is an issue on the ballot, a referendum or a proposition or initiative, they would be able to, if they want to weigh in, if they have been weighing in as a group on that issue one way or the other. So then they would be able to have a poll watcher. And that's the limitations, that's the sidebars that are put on poll watchers.
Thank you.
Okay.
Other question?
Sure. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, now one of the witnesses that came and testified earlier today spoke about the ability to appeal your vote not being counted. And I'm wondering, is there currently a way for someone whose vote isn't counted to appeal? If not, you know, why not?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, Alaska. There are specific Alaska statutes that tell us, or the division, how we're supposed to handle those ballots that are missing information, and that we are supposed to reject them under that particular statute at this time.
So there's no appeal process?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, no.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux. Actually, Representative Tuck, do you want to respond to that?
Yes. And I'm not sure, but I believe that when it does not affect the outcome, then it doesn't go to a higher level. But I believe it can go to a higher level if it can affect the outcome, in which the division elections will be contacting people individually. So in the cases where someone may not got a letter that their ballot didn't count, it may not have any effect on the outcome of the election. So if there was 50 of those, but it was a 100-point spread, then it wouldn't have an effect. However, if there's 50 of those and there was a 25-point spread, 25-vote spread, then they would be contacting. There is the additional layer, and correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Representative Tuck, through the chair? Is that how that works?
Go through the chair.
Thank you, sir.
Your name as well.
Carol Thompson, Division Elections. Thank you, sir. We do allow for in recount, if we were to have a recount, ballots are looked at again through the recount process, but we still have to follow the guideline of Alaska statute that says how we count or not count a ballot. You can challenge a vote through the recount or even the observation process. So if we are in the process of reviewing ballots, candidates and can have a member, a person there to observe the process, and they can challenge the validity of a count of a ballot or even the rejection of a ballot. And that challenge, we would look at that and go back to the law.
Mr. Chair, question?
Representative Eastman, go ahead.
Thank you for that. I had an experience in this last election that was a little bit different than that. And you mentioned that, you know, candidates could have someone to observe. You know, I myself went down to my local division of elections to observe the count in my own race. And when I got there, I was told that I couldn't observe, and that the local office needed to get permission from a higher office, and the higher office hadn't provided that permission, so I did not have that opportunity. I was wondering, have those policies been changed since the last election?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I don't know exactly what the whole circumstances were to be able to address that. I'm sorry. Yeah, that would.
Thank you.
All right. I've just got a couple of comments, and then I think what we're going to do is hold this bill for a future hearing, and I'll discuss with the bill sponsor about how you want to proceed with the bill. I just have a couple of notes. It doesn't really require response, although you may want to look into it before the next time. The first is when there's this whole idea that's pretty interesting about canceling your registration in another state, and I think it's kind of akin to canceling a driver's license. We kind of like this idea that everyone's very equipped, that we go, you know, when we move to Alaska, for example, we carefully go down to California and say to California, oh, I'm giving up my California driver's license, I'm giving up my California voter ID, and I'm giving up all these things in California, and the first day we arrive in Alaska, we change that status in Alaska, and you know that's our first priority. But the practical reality is we're like packing up to move from California or Washington, wherever, and it's a flurry at the end, and we forget all those things, and we get to Alaska, and about 12 months later, we suddenly say, oh, there's an election coming up, and I've got to register. Hopefully within the first month, people sign up for their driver's license. But we don't routinely have this process for unregistering, and so the notion, but part of what's in the bill is this idea that when you register in Alaska, you unregister in someplace else. That's a really good idea because I think the average person in the public, in fact, probably wouldn't even know where to write to the voter registry in Montana and say, oh, by the way, I'm now in Alaska. They kind of like this idea that the states are communicating with each other. Whether or not we are is kind of an open question, but I do think it makes a lot of sense that one can register and at the same time check a box and say I'm unregistering somewhere else. And to the extent that's lacking in the bill, I would certainly encourage provision. This is not questions. This is just comment for the bill sponsor. Okay. And then the other thing I would just note as I look through, I think the effort to call all these early voting ballots, and then question ballot is something different, which is where something is on hold so you can determine whether, in fact, they're qualified. I think that the trying to define all the early and absentee and other ballots as just early ballots is really good, but as I looked through the bill, you didn't do it very well. And I would say it should actually, there should be a definition that says early ballot includes absentee and all the others, and then call them early ballots throughout, because even though the goal is to say early and absentee, a bunch of it has people showing up on election day and getting an absentee ballot. Well, actually, they should either be getting the ballot because it's election day, or it should be a question ballot, and anything before election day is an early ballot. And so I actually really applaud the motion, the idea to simplify the name so people don't get so confused, but it looks to me, as I got my yellow highlighter out, that there's a lot of absentee ballots that are still referenced, and I think it would be useful to try to clean that up. But those are just comments. And we are going to hold this bill for further review. Our intention was to take up House Bill 13, but we're working up on 330, and I'm not going to start House Bill 13 today. We will pick up House Bill 13 at tomorrow's calendar, which hopefully will get off the floor in time. We are going to adjourn for the day, and our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, Saturday, April 15th at 1 p.m. Of course, if the House floor runs late, we will likely plan to meet 15 to 20 minutes after we adjourn from the floor. On Saturday, we will, in addition to hearing House Bill 13, we will also hear House Bill 200, Nonpartisan Open Primary Elections, sponsored by Representative Ledoux. Again, if anyone is considering offering an amendment to House Bill 200, please let my office know and submit them by 5 p.m. this evening. And I just want to, I thought a little bit more about Representative Eastman's question about a request he made a week or two or several days ago to Ledge League, and it hasn't come back. If you've made that request and you show the email that came several days ago and you haven't gotten back, just send us that email and we can take it up as a conceptual amendment. I think it's very reasonable if you haven't got it from Ledge Legal, but you can show that you really made an effort to get it from them, then it would not be my intention to foreclose amendments. If all you could show me was that at 4 o'clock today you sent an email to Ledge Legal and said, I didn't get anything back, then you will probably find me very unreceptive to a late arriving amendment. But if you're request that we consider a conceptual amendment shows that you've made a real effort to get that on time, and Ledge Legal has been the folks in your way. I'm not going to let us take it up as a conceptual amendment. I think it's very reasonable to have deadlines and expect people to do their research and be prepared. And so I do think those deadlines are important, but I'm not going to prejudice anyone because Ledge Legal is swamped with so many different things. And so with that, we're going to stand adjourned. It is now 3:25 p.m. Happy Good Friday, everyone.